Okay, last time, we stopped in the middle of the questions, where we spoke about the mitzvos 311, which is regarding the laws of Rosh Hashanah. We mentioned that even though the Torah itself doesn't say anything concerning what is the meaning of Rosh Hashanah? Why do we have to commemorate the first day of the seventh month? We see it through different hints that this is the day of judgment, right? It says Zichron Torah. It's a day of remembrance. And remembrance means that God sort of, so to speak, remembers your actions. So what is the point of remembering your actions? Obviously, judging your actions. So we asked two questions. One question, why is it, if Rosh Hashanah is the day of judgment, that is the beginning of the new year, it should have been the last day of the past year. That's the day or the last moment of the year that just passed. As we see that according to the Kabbalistic literature, there is like a monthly cycle with a monthly day of judgment. And according to the Kabbalistic tradition, when does it happen? The day, the last day of the month. They even call it the small Yom Kippur. Right? Yom Kippur Kotel. And that fits because if you are going to be judged for your actions for that month, it should not be the beginning of the next month. It's not on Rosh Chodesh. It is on the last day of the past month. So if so, the question is, why isn't the day of judgment, the last day of the year? And the second question, which is asked, is the following. Right after Rosh Hashanah, we have the laws of Yom Kippur. This is Mitzvah 313. We are going to go into the details of about the laws of Yom Kippur, but the idea of Yom Kippur. What is the day of Yom Kippur? We translated the day of atonement, the day of forgiveness. Now, logically, what would you say? What should precede what? Should the day of judgment, Rosh Hashanah, precede the day of atonement or vice versa? Let's compare it to a normal case in front of a judge. You would definitely ask for forgiveness from the judge before he passes judgment and not afterwards, right? In order that the forgiveness should be part of his judgment. So why do we wait until Yom Kippur for atonement? Okay. Now, there is a tradition in the Talmud which says the following. Even though we call Rosh Hashanah, the beginning of the year, the day of judgment, for some people it is, but not for everybody. A very strange statement in the Talmud. Some people, extreme cases, are judged in Rosh Hashanah. But anyone not belonging to the extreme, they have 10 days. What's the point of that? It says, in the words of the rabbis, very righteous or very evil people, reshaim gmurim, very evil or very righteous people, they are judged on Rosh Hashanah. But everybody in the middle, which makes up 99.999% of the people, they have 10 days for the judgment. And they call the days the 10 days that include Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, the 10 days of return. That's what they call it. What's the idea behind it? Why does God need 10 days for the average person and it's sufficient one day for the extreme cases? So in order to understand all the problems that we mentioned, let me tell you over what the commentaries say concerning the meaning of Rosh Hashanah. And again, we are going to introduce the concept with another very, very difficult question. And the question itself is the answer. There is a very strange halakha, very strange law concerning Rosh Hashanah. Do you know that before Rosh Hashanah, we say slichot? How would you translate slichot? Admissions, how else? Confessions, admissions, right? That's the essential part of the slichot. Right? Some people, some Jews among the Sephardic community, they started from a month before. By the Ashkenazi Jews, they started the week before sometimes. And the idea is preparation for Rosh Hashanah. It makes sense that you should say the slichot, you should say those prayers leading at the end to the confession, to the admission of your sins, right? Which is the most important part, because without that, then there is no forgiveness. That's it. You're lost, right? So what would you say Rosh Hashanah should consist of? Right? That's the goal. That's the objective. The slichot is a preparation for Rosh Hashanah. So you might think that Rosh Hashanah is made up. The prayers of Rosh Hashanah are all confessions and admissions of guilt. True? Well, not at all. Not only isn't it the main part of the prayer, but they were intentionally taken out of the prayer. Do you hear? On Rosh Hashanah, do not confess. Do you hear the law? Isn't it an extremely strange law? This is the day of judgment, but do not confess. You can confess on every Monday and Thursday. You know, there are many communities, they confess, right? They say, Ashamnu Bagana, they confess every Monday and Thursday, right? That's fine. But not on Rosh Hashanah, because that's the day of judgment. I mean, how does that make sense? How does it make sense? Even more, let me tell you something else, which seems on the surface absurd. You know, there is a prayer, Avinu Malkeinu, our Father, our King. Now, the version that we have normally is that the first one says, Avinu Malkeinu, our Father, our King, Chatanu Lefanecha, we have sinned in front of you. So in the in many, many commentaries, they say, take it out in Rosh Hashanah. Don't say it. Do you hear? Incredible. Don't say it. Why? Because it sounds like a confession, right? Chatanu lefanecha, we have sinned against you. Oh, no, don't mention any sin. Sin is a dirty word on Rosh Hashanah. Does that make sense? On Rosh Hashanah, that should be the word that we should talk about. Sin, right? And how to rectify the sin. No. Rosh Hashanah, don't mention any sin. And one of the commentaries says, well, you know, those people who do say it, make sure that while you are saying that, you do not have in mind your own sin. Because again, that makes it into a dirty word. Think in general about the sins of our ancestors, that we are still suffering the consequences. But don't think personally about sins, because it won't fit with Rosh Hashanah. What are they telling you? So you know what they are telling you? They are telling you what is the nature of Rosh Hashanah. Do you know that Maimonides says that tshuva, the whole process of tshuva, has basically three parts. One, recognition of sin. If you want to return, if you want to rectify, number one, you have to recognize that you did something wrong. That's the first part. But once that is established, yes, I am a thief. I am dishonest. I've stolen. Now, what should I do about it? Two things, says Maimonides. Number one, it has to hurt you that you did it. Recognition is not enough. It has to bother you. You have to recognize the damage that it did to you. Right? That is, in the words of Maimonides, regret about the past. Charata ale avar. Regretting the past. I recognize that it has damaged me spiritually. But that's not enough either. You have to accept in the future not to do it. So, Kabbalah Aleatid, accepting that the future is going to be different, is a crucial part of the process of tshuva. Okay, so there are three parts. Recognition of the sin, working on your past, and working on the future. Now, if we were to think, what is more important? Working on your past, dwelling on the past, or the future? So, the commentaries say, without any question, the future is more important than the past. Even more than that. The only reason we even dwell on the past is in order to rectify the future. Otherwise, we wouldn't even think about the past. Which means, the crucial thing is that a person should decide, from now on, life is going to be different. From now on, I'm going to be what I should be. Now, we know that a lot of people are held back by their knowledge about themselves. They think they know themselves and they say, who am I fooling? I know myself. What does it mean? I won't lie anymore. I lie all the time. I know myself. That's my weakness. Right? So what will that do? When a person knows his weakness, very often he thinks of himself as being a slave to that weakness. To the point that they say, I'm not going to fool myself. I'm not going to change. Let's forget about the whole process of tshuva. So very often you become a slave of your past. The goal of Rosh Hashanah is to break your chains with the past. Look at the future as if you have no past at all. You hear this idea? Look at the future, which means plan your life according to the way your life should be, not according to your pragmatic attitude that I know myself better. What should I, what I'm going to plan to be, to study Torah 10 hours a day. I know that after a half hour I can't do it anymore. No, don't say that. Don't say that. What do you think you should be doing? If you think that at your level you should be studying 5 hours a day, plan your life accordingly. If you think that at your level you should never say a lie again, plan your life accordingly. Okay? Be unrealistic on Rosh Hashanah. Now, do you hear why it has to be the beginning of the year, not the end of last year? You are breaking away from last year. You are starting, you are turning over a new page. It's a new year. Forget about the past. The goal of Rosh Hashanah is to rectify the future. And don't allow your past to hold you back. That is the goal. Okay? Now, so on Rosh Hashanah, we are commanded to be unrealistic. Not practical. Not pragmatic. That's what is our obligation. This answers the questions why Rosh Hashanah is the beginning of the year. Right? That answers also the problem of why Rosh Hashanah precedes Yom Kippur. Why? Because on Rosh Hashanah, you have already planned your life for next year. But you have to come down to the reality of life. The reality of life is that your past does affect your personality and your character and what you are going to do. So you have 10 days to close the gap between your ideal you and your real you, right? Your real you is you're a liar, you're dishonest, right? You're a glutton, whatever it is. So that is your reality, but you also have your ideal you. You have 10 days to close the gap, okay? And for that, we need Yom Kippur, okay? So what does Yom Kippur do? Somehow Yom Kippur is supposed to help you bridge the gap to the point that your ideal plan shouldn't contradict with the real you. Now, remember the question, why extreme people, complete tzaddikim, very righteous people or very evil people, don't need 10 days? Because what is the nature of someone who is a complete tzaddik, an extreme righteous man? The ideal and the real are the same. I mean, you understand? There is no gap. If there is no gap, then what? He doesn't need the 10 days. The same thing is with an evil person. The evil person, his plans and the reality are the same. There is no gap. That's what makes them into a very evil person. Rosh Gamur. So they don't need to close the gap. This is the meaning of the Talmudic statement that extreme people don't need the 10 days and Rosh Hashanah is sufficient for them. That's the end of the line for them, of course. But for 99.9% of the people in the world, there is a gap. And that gap has to be closed. This is what Yom Kippur is all about. Okay? Yeah.
You said that concerning Rosh Hashanah, we are not to adopt the pragmatic approach when it comes to...
The exact opposite. Be impractical. Right.
Are we also to assume that this is to be on a perennial basis? I mean, that year after year after year after year, we are coming before the Almighty and we are saying... Last year I didn't improve.
Right.
And I'm just the same.
Absolutely. That's the
year
whole point.
After year.
Because if you say, well, for the last 5 years, I know myself, for the last 80 years,
years,
you know,
whatever
it is. If you do that, again, you're becoming a slave of the past. So there is never a chance for you. If you will allow, right, your history to affect your decisions, you'll never break out of it. So you are a slave of your past. That's what Rosh Hashanah is doing. It's breaking the chains of your past. That's the idea behind it.
How do you think about why you have Rosh Hashanah before
Yom Kippur? So that's the whole point. If you would dwell on the past, Yom Kippur is to adjust, to go back to the past, the reality of life, and to adjust the past, bring it up to the level of your ideal. That's the goal of Yom Kippur. If you would have Yom Kippur first, then it would destroy you. Because again, you would be focusing on the past, And then you would never be able to build on the future because you would become too realistic, pragmatic. That's not what the Torah wants. Exactly. You complete despair, Yom Kippur first. Just the opposite, because you have an ideal. And God says the ideal is extremely important, and the job of Yom Kippur is only to close the gap. Oh, so that's the meaning of the, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur. So this is why there is such a stress. Don't confess on Rosh Hashanah. Why? Because confession would imply what? Focusing on the past. We don't want you to focus on the past on Yom Kippur. Focus only on the future, what you think the ideal you should be. And every normal person has a vision, an image of his ideal self. How would you really like to be? Forget about your weaknesses, but how would you really like to be? That is the image you should work on Rosh Hashanah. Okay? Any other question on this? Now, let's talk about... somebody else? Okay, some of the laws of Yom Kippur. This is Mitzvah 313. The fasting on Yom Kippur, Latsum Yom Ha'asiri B'Tishrei, V'hu Anikra Yom HaKippurim, and then he quotes the verse, Misharashei HaMitzvah. What is the idea behind the mitzvah to fast on the Day of Atonement? Because we see that Rosh Hashanah, there is no obligation to fast, even though it is a Day of Judgment, it's just the opposite. You should be in a good mood, right? It's a holiday. You should eat, you should enjoy yourself. That's one of the great acts of mercy of God al Briotav to his creatures. Likvoa lahem yom echad bashana, to assign one day, lechaper al hachataim, to erase, to atone for the sins. Im hachuva, of course, as long as a person does tshuva. Lefi shehamachal, because food and drink, shehamachal ve'amishte, v'yeter hana'at hamishus, and all other sensual pleasures, ye'oraru hachomer, strengthen the physical side of you. Lehimashech achara ta'ava. And that causes like a chain reaction. The more you give in to your physical desires, the more you will need physical desires, physical fulfillment. And that makes you more vulnerable to sin. And then that destroys the soul, etc., etc. So therefore, and that stops you from finding the truth. When a person is full, when his stomach is full, it's very difficult to hear the truth, to be able to be objective. So he says, therefore a person should fast. Okay, so that's the idea behind. The idea is because since the atonement requires tshuva, and the tshuva is associated with not eating, because eating, on the surface he's saying, is something which brings you to sin. Now, is that a Jewish attitude? On the surface, it's very, very difficult what he's saying. He's saying that Yom Kippur is so special because you don't eat, and of course, if you want to do something good, if you want to decide good things, you can't eat because food is the enemy of your soul. That's what it sounds like he's saying. He's not saying that at all. I'm just putting it into his words, right? Let me just bring out the point that in Judaism, that idea doesn't exist. We do not believe that the body is the enemy of the soul. The whole concept of Shabbat and Onek Shabbat, the pleasure that you are supposed to derive from the Sabbath, tells you the exact opposite. It tells you that that the physical is not the enemy of the spiritual. Just the opposite. Shabbat teaches you that through the physical, you can have a spiritual experience. Right. So why was it necessary for Yom Kippur to become a Yom Tzom, a day of fasting? Why? Right. Just because it's holy. So since when is there a contradiction between holiness and food? Okay. So the commentaries say that the following. All holidays have some connection with a historical date, like Rosh Hashanah, we say, the birth of Adam, right? Passover, the Jews went out of Egypt. Shavuot, the receiving of the Torah. Sukkot, I don't know if you remember, one spoke about the return of the clouds that covered the Jews in the desert. Everything is connected with some historical event. What is Yom Kippur? Which historical event is remembered in Yom Kippur? Or is it just a day that comes 10 days after Rosh Hashanah? Is that all it is? No, according to our tradition, it does represent a specific historical event. What? Yeah? Exactly. Yeah. It's the giving of the second tablets. The first tablets were given on Shavuot. The 10 sayings, the 10 Aseret HaDibrot, the so-called 10 commandments were given on Shavuot. The second set of commandments were given on Yom Kippur. Because it says that after Shavuot, 40 days later, Moshe comes down, he breaks the first tablets. Eventually, he goes up again to Mount Sinai for 40 days, starting on Rosh Chodesh, the beginning of the month of Elul. And he stays there another 40 days. So when does that come out? More or less. Right? The 10th day of Tishrei, right? For 40 days from Rosh Chodesh Elul, the 10th day of Tishrei. So that's our tradition, that on Yom Kippur, God finally accepts the prayer of Moshe Rabbeinu and forgives the Jews. And says, Salachti, I've forgiven the Jews. So therefore, that is... We remember that very special event, the Day of Atonement, which means that had the Jews not sinned with the Egel, how does it all develop? The Jews received the first tablets, right? But Moshe Rabbeinu is forced to break it. Why? Because of the sin of the golden calf, right? Therefore, Moshe Rabbeinu has to go up again to Mount Sinai and receive a second set of tablets. But let's speculate. What would have happened if the Jews would have not sinned with the golden calf? Then there would be no Yom Kippur. Right? Which means Yom Kippur is... There would be no need for Yom Kippur. Right? So Yom Kippur represents a weakness of the Jewish people. That's what it reminds us of. Now, we know that when we are strong enough, the physical is not a contradiction to the spiritual. But you have to be very, very strong. Because you have to be in control, like the commentaries say. When God said to Adam, be fruitful and multiply and control the world, you know what God meant? God meant that you should use the world, utilize the world for your benefit, enjoy the world for your benefit, anything you want to do. But do not become a slave to nature. Be a master over nature and not a slave over nature. When you eat something and you enjoy it, that's fine, because you are showing mastery over nature. When you are drinking wine, that's great, because you are showing mastery over nature. You enjoy wine, so drink it. It's fine. What about if you start realizing that by drinking wine, you are becoming hooked on wine? To the point that you miss it when you don't have it. And you start looking around and you start getting angry. Hey, where is my wine? You know what has happened. Instead of you being the master over wine, you have become a slave of wine. Now, why do I focus on wine? Because wine became a symbol of your relationship with the pleasures of nature. If you want, you can take wine and sanctify the Sabbath with wine. You can elevate the wine to the point that that becomes an instrument in your relationship with God. You make kiddush on wine. But if you are not careful, right, then wine will be the master over you, and then what is the only way? Once wine became the master over you, I mean, I can talk about anything, I can talk about cigarettes, chocolate, food, anything. Right? You know what is the only way once it has become your master? There is no other remedy. Abstention is the only remedy. Because at that point, wine has become your enemy. Do you hear this? This is why the Torah says, if you see that wine is becoming the controller of your life, you have no choice. What should you become? A Nazir, a person who abstains from wine. So you hear that, an interesting thing. Wine can become the instrument with which you sanctify the Sabbath, the holiest day, which means that wine, through wine, you can elevate your body to the point that you are having a spiritual experience through wine, and wine can become your worst enemy. Okay? Why? Because when you are weak, then you have no other choice but abstention. What did we say Yom Kippur represents? The weakness of the Jews. When they gave in to their desires, because without going into too many details, the act of bowing down to the golden calf, that is an act of weakness. Okay? It's really, it's bowing down to my desires, to my needs, what I want, not what God wants. We believe that real freedom is only in serving God. God represents all the ideals of a Jew, justice, truth, goodness. That's what serving God means. Serving yourself is giving into yourself. Bowing down to the golden calf meant breaking away from God, giving into yourself. So therefore, which is the only method once you have reached that point? Abstention. Therefore, Yom Kippur, which is the way that we atone for our weakness? Through abstention. Don't eat. Okay? This is the reason why Yom Kippur doesn't follow the pattern of the other holidays. The other holidays tell you, go ahead, enjoy yourself, right? Be in a state of happiness. Eat as much as you want. Sure, go ahead. Yom Kippur tells you the opposite. Why? Because Yom Kippur represents the Jews in a much lower state, in a weak state. They need to regain control. You can't regain control without abstention. You must abstain first. Okay, so this is the idea behind it. Now, in the process of tshuva, we mentioned before the three steps: recognition of the sin, working on your past, and working on the future. In the words of Maimonides, we find the following statement. Every person, right, must do tshuva in Yom Kippur, because that's the most appropriate day to do tshuva. Of course, tshuva is good throughout the year, but it's a specially appropriate day, Yom Kippur. And when we used to have the temple, there was a certain act which somehow represented the act of tshuva. What was it? There was a scapegoat. There were two goats. One goat was offered on the altar, and one goat was taken outside of the temple, and they threw down the goat over a cliff. Right? And somehow that act helps the process of atonement. Seir Lazazel, the scapegoat helps the process of atonement. So, first question is, what is the idea behind it? Taking a goat and throwing it down a cliff, how does that help the process of atonement? What is the idea behind it? You're going to say, well, because that's what should be done to us because of our sins. That's not the symbolism, because the symbolism should be just the opposite. Our offering ourselves to God on the altar. What is the idea of going out of the temple? Some of you may remember a very, very shocking statement by Nachmanides, the Ramban, trying to explain what is the idea of the scapegoat, right? By the way, that expression, which is a common expression in the world, people... He's the scapegoat of someone else, right? You say about people, he's a scapegoat. Comes from this halakha, this law. It's as if like the goat is a scapegoat for us. He represents us, so therefore he's our scapegoat. So what is the idea behind it, he says? He says, notice the fact that in Hebrew, in the Torah, you know what the name of the scapegoat is? Seir, that's the name of the goat, that's a goat. La'azazel. Now, the ending of the word Azazel, the word Az means something strong, like the cliff, it's like a hard place. But the ending, you know what it sounds like? Right, it's something divine, the ending Azazel, it's very strange. Came so identified with evil that we can't separate the evil from the person. So the only way to get rid of that evil is how? By getting rid of the person with a heavy heart. We do it, meaning because human beings are very important, but it comes to a point that the only way that you can do it is by operating, by cutting out the sickness. There is no other way, right? So that is Esau, because you know that Amalek is just one part of Esau. Amalek is a grandson of Esau, right? A grandson of Esau. He represents the concentration of evil in Esau, because Esau himself had good points too. So even the bad points of Esau became concentrated, polarized, like Amalek what became like the magnet of all evil in Esau. Yeah? It's possible. It's possible. Right. You know, theoretically. We have no way of knowing for sure, but it's possible. So now, once we recognize this, says the Ramban, we have to realize that those forces of evil, right? Whose responsibility is it? Right? Not God's. I mean, what can we blame God for the existence of Amalek in the world? Of Esau? Of Satan? Even of the angel of death? Can't blame God for that. Because according to God's original plan, those powers should have remained as a potential, but not as an actual power. You know what brought down all those powers, the powers of evil, from the level of the potential to the level of the actual? Man's sin. If man would not have sinned, all those powers would have existed, but they would have existed only in potential, right? Not de facto. This is why it says in the Torah, when did Adam become mortal? In other words, when did he become vulnerable to the angel of death? Only after he sinned, not before. That shows you clearly that the original plan of God was that all evil should remain there locked up as a potential, but not as something actual. We opened up the box, and of course evil came into the world. And the more we do evil, the stronger that power becomes. The less we do evil, so he becomes weaker. So theoretically, we can starve him to death. We can starve evil to death. Because what feeds evil? Our sins. Now, the idea, says Nachmanides, of taking the goat and taking it to that cliff outside of the temple, because what is the symbolism of outside of the temple? The other side. You know that there is an expression, the other side. We are taking it to the other side, which means we recognize that those powers exist, but by throwing the animal there, you know what else we are recognizing? That we are feeding the monster. We are feeding evil. Here, the symbolical meaning of the act of taking the animal and throwing it down there is the recognition of responsibility for evil in the world. We say to God, you know, God, we always complain to you. How can you allow this evil to happen? How can you allow that evil to happen? By doing that, we are saying, you know, God, we recognize we did it. We messed it up. Okay? That is the act of taking the scapegoat. So it doesn't mean that it's some magical thing that the scapegoat actually becomes instead of us. That's not the idea. The idea is that if we have the right intentions with the scapegoat, we'll recognize our responsibility for all the evil which exists in the world, and we will stop feeding the monster. That is the goal of the scapegoat. However, Maimonides adds the following statement. Therefore, the scapegoat helps you to atone for all your sins, whether you remember that you sinned or even when you don't remember that you sinned. It could be that you committed a sin that you don't even remember. It doesn't mean anything to you. If you are a thief, for instance, so are you going to remember every time you pickpocketed someone? It's very, very difficult to remember every detail. Or if you're a liar, how can you remember the details? You forgot. Says Maimonides, but the act of the scapegoat is so powerful that it will help you atone for everything you did, whether you remember that you did it or you don't remember that you did it. But on one condition, says Maimonides, ubilvad sheyaseh tshuva. You have to actually do tshuva. You have to really feel, you know, inside that you want to rectify your act. End of quote of Maimonides. As the commentaries, this statement in Maimonides is paradoxical within it. How can you do tshuva without knowing that you have sinned? Here, I'll repeat the statement again. The scapegoat helps you atone for all your sins, whether you remember that you sinned or you don't remember that you sinned. Right? As long as you do tshuva, how can you do tshuva for sins that you don't remember that you did? It's an incredible statement. How can you do tshuva? Let's say I did something wrong. I used somebody's pen without permission, thinking that it was mine. So I have to do tshuva for that. But I never found out that I did it. How can I do tshuva? Right? So it says in the commentaries the following idea. You know that Maimonides, in the second chapter of the Laws of Tshuva, he talks about the two types of tshuva. Tshuva has been broken up into many, many details. So he categorizes tshuva in this way. He says there is such a thing as tshuva gemura, complete tshuva, and there is such a thing as tshuva sheina gemura. Let's translate as partial tshuva. And he says, what is called tshuva gemura, complete tshuva? Complete tshuva means, and he gives the example. Let's say you committed a sin, right? You committed a sexual transgression. Now, you want to do tshuva, you realize that you did something wrong. So if you go back with the same woman, in the same romantic environment, right? With your same desire for this woman. So everything else being equal. And at that point you abstain and you don't sin, then it's tshuva gemura. Okay? Implication. But let's say you do tshuva for this sexual transgression without ever seeing that woman again. That's called what? Partial tshuva. So what does it sound like? Yeah, this is what Maimonides says. So what does it sound like on the surface? That Maimonides is encouraging me to test myself, to tempt myself again in order to do tshuva. Is that what Maimonides is telling me? That's impossible. Because we know that one of the things that we have to be super careful with is not to go into a situation of temptation. Don't test yourself. Avoid tests. One of the main advices that we get from the rabbis is keep away, lowly denis, and don't test yourself. If God wants to test you, fine. But don't put yourself in a situation when you are going to test your result. Right? Better keep away from that test. So my mind is telling me that that's the way to do tshuva, by returning to the same place today, right? It's incredible. So the commentaries say, no, that's not what Maimonides means at all. He means something else completely. He's trying to describe to you two types of tshuva. I use the following analogy just to see what Maimonides means. Let's say a person decided that he's going to eat kosher food. From now on, he decided that it's right, the Jews should eat kosher food. That's what Jews have been eating throughout their history. So from now on, I'll never eat non-kosher food again. Okay? So decision. The same day, right, I go to the office and I've been told that we have made a lunch appointment with a very, very important client, right? And my partners take me to their tremendous, luxurious restaurant. And I sit there and I say, well, I'm not going to eat, of course, because I made a decision. I'm not going to eat non-kosher food, but I'll sit there anyway and order a Coke. Fine. So I order the Coke and they order the most delicious food. And that food is especially attractive to me because they order special roast that I always love, right? So that, of course, works on my willpower, right? It's gnawing at my willpower. But, you know, I'm holding strong, right? And then all of a sudden I realize, hey, you know, I haven't eaten for the last 20 hours. You know, I forgot to eat breakfast when last night I ate, and I'm very, very hungry. That again, I mean, your hunger again works against your willpower. So there is a struggle within you already. Besides the point, all my partners start, you know, making jokes about me. Come on, or what kind of a fool are you? You're not going to eat this delicious food. Again, that's another force against my willpower. And my decision is becoming weaker and weaker and weaker. Okay? Until it collapses. And I say, okay, you know, so order for me too. And I also, so I transgress and I feel very badly. And I decide I want to do tshuva for going against my decision. How should I do tshuva? Well, what about if I say to myself the following? From now on, right, if it ever comes out that I have to go with my business partners to this special place, I'll always eat before, so I shouldn't be hungry. Because I realized that the reason why my decision collapsed, my will collapsed, was, one of the reasons was because I was hungry. So next time, I'll fill myself up with cookies before, so I won't be hungry. Now, is this a proper method of tshuva? Definitely, that is a proper method of tshuva. We will call it circumstantial tshuva, which means change the circumstances in order not to repeat the same situation that you were in before, and then you have a guarantee, or at least you have done your best in order not to repeat the sin. Or you can say to yourself, well, from now on, even if they insist, I'll never go into that restaurant, right? Or I'll only go in on condition that they don't order that food. That's also good, because I say, well, as long as they don't order the food, so my smell won't break down my decision. That's fine. That's a good method. But there is one method which is even better. What about if I work on myself to the point that I realize, what? Eating non-kosher food? Breaking with my tradition? How can I do that? Right? Being unfaithful in my relationship with God? You can come to such a level in your relationship with God that it becomes impossible for you to transgress. Right? You can reach such a level that it's not a test for you anymore. Right? If you have eaten kosher for long enough, the temptation of eating non-kosher food ceases to exist. That's a fact. Right? So what about if you work on your commitment to your religion, to your relationship with God, to the point that eating non-kosher food becomes an impossibility? At that level, can you go into the same restaurant again and order the same food and with the same partners and be the butt of their jokes again, and still you won't transgress? Of course, because then it's not a tshuva by changing the environment, right? By changing the circumstances. It's a tshuva because you changed yourself. Do you hear the difference? There is a tshuva which is based on, I am the same, but I will change the environment. Or, the environment is the same. It's I who am different. What does Maimonides mean when he says that the ideal tshuva is with the same woman, with the same romantic set, right? The same music, right? With your same desire, that is real tshuva. What is my man is telling you? He's not telling you to repeat the same mistake. He's telling you that you should change yourself, right? That it's not the circumstances that are making you do tshuva. It's that your change within yourself. That is what Maimonides is trying to tell you. Maimonides is not telling you to tempt yourself again, of course. Okay? So this is what Maimonides is bringing out. That there is such a thing as circumstantial tshuva, and there is such a thing as a tshuva, an essential tshuva, by changing your essence. Now, let me just conclude and I'll take questions. Now this is a little bit subtle, but it's very, very logical. If I am telling you to do circumstantial tshuva, like for instance, I did something wrong. A few days ago, I had to write down our telephone number. I saw a pen on the table, right? And without thinking, I lifted the pen and I wrote down the telephone number. Now, that you're not allowed to do. Why? Because using somebody else's object without his permission is tantamount to stealing. That's what we believe, right? So now I have to do tshuva. You know what could be a reasonable method of tshuva? That from now on I should always carry my own pen. Right? That's a reasonable method. Now, if I say, for instance, well, do tshuva for something that you don't know that you committed. Can I do circumstantial tshuva for a sin that I don't know that I committed? I mean, can I think of putting a pen in my pocket if I don't remember that I used somebody else's pen? Right? So it's impossible. Circumstantial tshuva you can't do unless you are aware of the specific sin that you committed and the circumstances of the sin. But what about the other tshuva? Tshuva gemura, what Maimonides says, that you lift yourself to the level that it's impossible for you to commit that sin. If I become extremely aware of the sin against using somebody else's object, without even thinking that I myself transgressed it, but from now on, using somebody else's object is like holding a bomb. You're holding, like, playing with fire to me. This is how I work myself up in my awareness of honesty. So can I do tshuva for something that I don't even know I committed? Definitely yes. Think about it. It's very subtle. The idea is circumstantial tshuva. You have to know exactly the details in order to do circumstantial tshuva. If you want to do tshuva gemura, the complete change within yourself, then the circumstances are absolutely secondary. So you don't have to remember every detail that you stole and you pickpocketed and you lied. You don't have to. If you become a really different person, an honest person, right? So obviously you are never going to do it again. Okay? So this is what Maimonides means. When Maimonides says that you can do tshuva without even remembering the sins, he's talking about tshuva gemura, that complete tshuva. Yeah.
The Rambam says that an example of tshuva gemura would be whether you're isolated with the same woman under the same circumstances, to use his example. And he is not meaning that you should deliberately place yourself in a compromised
definitely
situation.
Definitely, right.
What he appears to be saying, therefore, is that if you work on yourself, then the Almighty will put you in that.
No, I wouldn't say that.
And he will see to it that
I wouldn't accept that. I would say that Maimonides means that you have to do such a tshuva that even if that happens, you won't transgress. Not that you should.
It doesn't happen. It doesn't just happen.
Good. So that's what I mean. Meaning, hopefully it will never happen, right? That you will be tempted again, that you will go through the test again. Theoretically, I know what you mean. Now, theoretically, if he will do it for some unknown reason, I'm still strong enough to overcome it. That's correct, yeah.
Would it be a good thing to do, play the scenario over in your mind of that event taking place, not actually going out and looking for that situation, being the same romantic environment, same situation, but to, while you're doing the tshuva, play it in your mind, the possibility of it happening, and then not doing it.
The danger of it is that you know, it's very, very difficult to know how strong your commitment to tshuva is. You know, I mean, we are speaking in theory when a person knows for sure, but in reality, right, we should always have the little doubt in the back of my mind. Is my tshuva strong enough? I never know. So don't tempt yourself even in thought.
Okay.
Exactly. That's the idea behind it. Okay, we'll stop here. Okay, Odav Minche. Yeah, Odav Minche. Minche, yeah.